From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll speak with the founder of a humanitarian group about what he means by his call to think human.
Cellist Robert Cohen remembers the experience of performing music for audiences behind the Iron Curtain.
They were desperate to hear the music. You could feel that it was intensely important. Music was almost like an emotional freedom for them, a freedom they didn't have in other ways.
And the heroine in Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan's new novel, Dreams of Paris, and then one day finds herself there.
What does it mean when a place like Paris or the life you thought you were going to lead doesn't exactly turn out to square with that? How do you navigate the gap between the reality and myth that you had? I think it's one of the things that really obsesses her in the book.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Organizers of the Day Without Latinos actions last week say they hope the message of the march and rally extend well into the future.
In addition to calling attention to the role Latinos play in the local economy and the community at large, last week's events also sought to rally opposition to a federal rule known as 287G, which would allow sheriff's deputies to serve as de facto immigration agents.
Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo was at the rally and prepared this report.
Thousands of people gathered in Waukesha last week to march for Latino and immigrant rights. May 1st, also known as May Day, is celebrated to honor workers in many countries, and Sloan Butler marched to support Latino workers that contribute to her own community.
It's basic human rights, like regardless of your skin color, regardless of your heritage, regardless of where you come from, like what immigrants do for our country, like they do thankless jobs every day.
Waukesha teacher Greta Voigt says her Latino students seem worried when they come to school.
I know that the topic of immigration and the fear that's created by some of the more recent immigration policies is creating a ton of fear and anxiety with my students, and I want to make sure that we are working together to support our students and make sure that everyone feels safe.
Juan Corona, a teacher in Milwaukee, says he marched to set an example for his students.
What this does is it shows them representation, it shows them advocacy, is what we're trying to do for them as well. I mean, if the students are going to continue thinking that what's going on with the presidency, what's going on with these type of laws, it gives them the idea that they're powerless, they can't do anything, they're in a situation that they can't get out of. But what this does, what this march shows them is that there's advocacy. You can represent yourself and you can get something done with people who think the same.
Young students, like Gabriela Castro, had a big presence in the march. Gabriela is a junior at Pius High School in Milwaukee and said that the increased attention to immigration laws has impacted her family.
Well, definitely. Like, my dad, like, he's afraid to even go driving to work sometimes, and it's a legitimate fear. We can't say it's, like, not backed up because we've had raids near our home. It's fearful. You don't know when your parents are going to be there and when they're not.
The 287G program is designed to enforce immigration laws in the county jails. But Omar Carmona, who is originally from Mexico, says if this program isn't stopped, it will set a path for future immigration laws.
De hecho, este programa para ellos sería algo como el inicio para implementar más leyes.
This program for them would be the start to implement more laws, he says. So if we could stop this, we can stop them from making more laws. If this law goes into effect in Waukesha, it will create a snowball effect. And then one more passes, and one more. And then there will be many laws against the Hispanic community. We have to unite and stop all of this so they don't make another law and they can let us work in peace and be part of the community. We hope that everything turns out good so that I can have the opportunity to stay here, because the situation in Mexico is difficult, and above all, for my children, because the love for them is big and it's difficult to be separated from them. According to Sheriff Eric Severson, deputies will start immigration and customs enforcement training next month, but it will not affect their patrol operations. For WUWM, I'm Claudia Delgadillo.
You can find more coverage of immigration issues at WUWM.com.
Many immigrants' rights supporters implore people to think of immigrants not in terms of nationality or country of origin, but rather simply as fellow human beings.
Empathy towards other fellow humans is at the heart of Ravine Aurora's message. Aurora is a former refugee who once worked with Mother Teresa and now lives in Arizona and heads the Think Human Global Initiative.
Aurora was in Milwaukee as the keynote speaker at the International Institute of Wisconsin's World Citizen Celebration, and he joined us in the studio recently. It is an honor to speak with you.
Thank you for having me here today, and I appreciate the opportunity of speaking to your listeners.
So let me ask you kind of a big picture question. When you, say, get on an airplane and sit down next to someone, if that person is being talkative and asks you what you do, what your work is, what's the first thing that you tell them?
Mostly I don't like to talk about myself, because what happens is people end up talking more about themselves than about others. And I have learned to listen, to understand, then to respond quickly, and to just do idle chatter, just so that the time of the flight is covered, basically, because sometimes it's much ado about nothing. But if they do, I do extend a warm hand of, like, how are you? And my name is Ravine. And I let him or her initiate. But I will initiate if I'm sitting down, if I'm on the aisle seat, if somebody's there, I'll introduce myself. Is it okay if I'm not intrusive, if they have a bag there or something? I try to be as accommodating and friendly in the 2-hour flight or a 1-hour flight or a 10-hour flight. That's about my culture. It comes from upbringing. It's respecting other person's space. I won't be too loud on the phone, take away their time or space, or, they are doing something, but that's about it.
Well, and it seems like that philosophy would inform the work of someone who is working on, if you will, humanity.
Absolutely. It's about respect and dignity of the other person's space. It's not about me. It's the why. The why is basically defines that once you can define the why, my purpose is in humanitarian work is to be human and to be humane, to understand if the other person is, let's say, their arm or the elbow is sitting on my thing, on my seat rest.
The armrest, right?
Armrest. Am I going to push him away, or am I going to be tolerant? Am I going to be patient, be accommodating? If I don't need that armrest, would I just make myself a little bit, more accommodating? Yes, because that's the basis of everything, because everybody's in a shared space. We are not in an island. In a shared space, the plane is a classic example. With 300, 200, 150 come together, it's part of our life, okay, and that we are spending time together. Okay, we may not talk to each other, but we are, again, passengers on the same train. It's the same journey we're undertaking, and that's how we define life, is the passengers on my life. The life is a journey, and these are the passengers on our train that we co-share the space. We don't know when our station will come if we're on a train. So I would say thank you for being a good passenger, co-passenger on my journey, too.
So if the why is the key question that you are interested in, let me ask you, if you don't mind talking about yourself a little bit, why is this the work that you do?
Because my beginnings are very humble. I'm a refugee child from Calcutta. My parents are refugees. I was born in a refugee camp. So once a refugee, people say you're always a refugee. But I feel I wear that badge of honor gracefully, because it shows courage. It shows strength, it shows victory, that you have taken a stand not to be oppressed. You'd rather rather go into the unknown and take your chances than to be subservient to the circumstances or be a falling prey, because we are not a pawn on the chessboard. You are human. So what it has taught me was resilience. It taught me tolerance. It taught me patience. It taught me understanding. So as I grew, you know, work with Mother Teresa and working with humanitarian agencies, Lions Club, Leo Clubs, Rotary, Kiwanis, I've done it all because all roads lead to the same. It's about service, about understanding each other, about caring for each other. And so when the opportunity came from becoming a refugee, from a refugee to a refuge, I said the best thing I can do is create a global initiative that will teach people, teach the younger people about respect, about caring for each other, because we are not an island, we are an ocean. Every drop counts. Every drop counts. Serving each other, being with each other, understanding each other's, because that's where the cultural dexterity comes in, because we are so connected that multiculturalism, which results from cultural dexterity of diversity of thought, diversity of perspective, diversity of opinion, diversity of dissent, what I call it, I encourage dissent, is to unite, not despite our differences, but through our differences. We have to stay united because, after all, we are all human.
Where were your parents refugees from?
When India was split, they became refugees in their own country, basically, because they, for thousands of years, their ancestors had lived in Punjab, which was the cradle of human civilization, which Mark Twain had rightly called. The British split it based on religion in 1947. They lost everything. They were highly educated. Education was a key there because they always felt that education may be an ornament in prosperity, but it's your refuge in adversity. And when Britain split, my dad always felt that, no, nothing will happen, nothing will happen. But based on religious strife, a million people were killed. And he took the last refugee train that was there. It took him months. Mom and dad were split, and they came to Calcutta. And dad had to play dead in a refugee train just to stay alive, because mom was carrying me, and I was born in a refugee camp. So that scar still stays with me. I bear those scars 70 years later.
What did it take, given those circumstances, first what your parents had to live through, and secondly, the way you grew up, what did it take to learn patience in that environment?
Because of the cultural exclusion, the social exclusion, cultural exclusion, because it was more a stigma. When you don't have it, people don't want to, you know, be with you. People, there is a class system. Like we used to have a color system, your class. We had a caste system, and then the rich, the haves and the have-nots. When that happens, when you go to a poor school, you play with the slum kids, you know, you've never been invited to a birthday party till because your parents can't afford to give you a gift, you know, or you can't afford a school bus. Those were the times when you learn resilience, you learn tolerance and patience with yourself, because you've got to come out. And the only way out of poverty is not out, is up. Because poverty will lead to, hunger. Hunger will lead to starvation. And do you want to starve yourself? Starvation will lead to malnutrition, which will lead again to lack of education. Did I want that life? I said no. So I'll have to be patient, make books my refuge, make do with little, come out and sustain myself. It was more for me than for anything else. I did not think much about others who had more than me. I began to realize that I have to be grateful for what I have and not what I prefer. I am in a world that I didn't choose, but this is the world I live in, not what I prefer. So that taught me a whole lot of patience. And working with Mother Teresa, of course, reinforced the values of kindness and, you know, humility and tolerance. So those were my big takeaways.
How did you happen to come to work with Mother Teresa?
I went to school in a Jesuit school, and that time she was known as Sister Teresa. And if we volunteered, we stepped up and did something else, then we would get credits for a movie credit because movies were expensive, even though they cost like a couple of pennies in those days. But we could not afford a movie ticket. So my first movie was like Gunfight at the OK Corral or Around the World in 80 Days or Ten Commandments. And to be able to go there, I had to do something for others. Okay, Sister Teresa used to live about a mile away from our house, and she would help us, my sisters and us, to go to charity. My first full breakfast actually was with Mother Teresa because I had never had an omelet before, an egg, because Mom would add water to the milk to stretch it. So there is how I met, and I saw that there were people who had less than me, much less than me. I was still there. So that led to a long association of 16, 18 years when I became the president of Leo Clubs, Lions Clubs in Calcutta, working with Rotaract, working with children. And then everything centered around projects and centered around involving ourselves with social work, what we used to call it. We started a night school with Mother Teresa Blessed. And 50 years later, I was there last month to receive Mother Teresa International Award, Service Award for my work with refugees and humanitarian work in 90 countries. That school still exists. It's got 25,000 students, and it still exists. And that, you know, completed my one part of my journey, because what I learned, the basic values that I learned then, haven't changed, because the poor don't need. We talk about poor people. We talk about poverty. But how many of us like the smell of the poor? Very few. How many of us can hug a poor man? How many of us can hug a leper? So because we bleed the same.
Can you talk about how Think Human goes about the work that it does?
Think Human is an initiative. We don't want to ask people to join. We want them to feel that in them. So it works through workshops, it works through seminars, it works through my own message. What it is telling people about empathy. We cannot feel. Sympathy is an action. Empathy is the feeling. Okay? Empathy concerns the heart. Start treating people. Don't look on the title, don't look at the color, don't look at the sexual leanings, don't look at gender, don't look at minorities. Because at the end of it, there's only one race. That's a human race, you know? And we need to be thinking human. Before we do the command and control politics, we should have empathy.
Over the years that you have been involved in this work, the question I have is whether there is something about 2018, the year that we're in, that makes it either easier or harder for you to help people understand perhaps the difference between sympathy and empathy.
It's a very sensitive subject right now, because the times, as hard as they seem or as dark as they seem, I still feel there is humanity, underlying humanity. If we take politics out of our thinking, of our life, if we take care of our blind spots, internal blind spots, we don't have to be politically correct. We can relate to people. We are so globally connected, interdependent on each other today, that other than thinking human, other than thinking logically with our heart and head to collaborate, you know, the result would be disaster, because everybody's trigger happy. Everybody's technologically advanced today. We can take things for granted. The only way we can take things for granted is through tolerance, through patience, through understanding the perspective, because we have to bring them around. Persuasive means what I call it. 2018 is going to be a very defining year. It's not about our summit with North Korea, or it's not about our summit with other things that are happening. We are polarized. Okay, it's not the North-South thing. The world wasn't made North-South. World was made north, south, east, west. You know, the globe is round. Earth is round. So what goes around will come around to bite us, because that's what typically happens. Because if we try to do something it comes back in a different way. If we say we raise minimum wages, what happens, Mitch? We raise, the product goes up. Okay, the cost of the product goes up. If we say now we need to compete, we're going to cut the jobs, productivity suffers. Then social welfare. So we have to realize that we are so interconnected, interdependent on every action or every thought, because at the end of it, our thoughts become our words. Our words become our actions. Our actions turn into habits, and habits become our character. And that's what defines it. So we have to remember, you know, the basic fundamental thing is tolerance.
Ravina Arora, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Best of luck with your work.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Ravin Arora is the founder and CEO of Think Human Global Initiative. He was in Milwaukee to give the keynote speech at the International Institute of Wisconsin's World Citizen Celebration, and we spoke with him then.
A quick break now, and then contributor Robert Cohen joins us for his monthly conversation about the life of a working, touring classical musician. He and Bonnie North talk about what it's like to play in Bulgaria. When Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. What do you know about Bulgaria? Most of us, if we have any thoughts about it, think of a dark, mysterious place behind the Iron Curtain. And though democracy came to Eastern Europe in the 1990s, Bulgaria still brings to mind a place largely closed off from the modern world.
That's, of course, not exactly the case in 2018. It's a place where cellist Robert Cohen recently performed, and for this month's On That Note segment, he joins Bonnie North to talk about that experience. He says he was actually excited to be back in that part of the world.
And actually, just next door to Romania, which was where I did my first ever concerto tour when I was 19, going from city to city, playing with a soloist with the different orchestras, and that was really a dark time. I think it was Ceausescu who was in charge at the time, very much a communist state. And when I was 19, I had no experience of such extraordinary kind of atmosphere, and it was very dark. And when I think I was about 20 or 21, and I won this UNESCO competition in Czechoslovakia, as it was called then. And then I was invited to perform in 23 of the other member states, and a lot of them in the Eastern European community at that time, and the Eastern Bloc countries. So I started to get quite experienced at what to expect and how things felt in those countries, including Bulgaria. And, you know, going back there recently, so many years later, I have actually been going there for the last, I don't know, even 20 years on a fairly regular basis. But I'm always reminded how that feeling was, those countries, and being somebody from the West arriving and being kind of lauded. And at the same time, you go and give a concert, and there was this incredible excitement. Everybody crammed into the concert halls, or the aisles and the stairs full of people. I mean, nowadays they'd probably, you know, fire regulations would never allow that sort of thing. But they were there, and they were desperate to hear the music. You could feel that it was intensely important. Music was almost like an emotional freedom for them, that freedom they didn't have in other ways. And so they were drinking it up, and they would never let me out of the hall. I was playing encore after encore because they just didn't want the concerts to end. And you felt that this space where everybody was gathering was a spiritual meeting place, and music was the reason for it. And that seemed to be the common factor in all of those countries that I went to. The music was, you know, somehow really joyous for them. But when you went outside after the concert, they would follow you, literally walk, hundreds of people walking back through the streets to your hotel, just to be around you, maybe to talk to you, just to kind of feel that you brought something special to them. And at the same time, you saw their faces once they were out of the concert hall, where they were smiling and beaming and cheering and everything. They were somehow back to being very solemn and sad and not smiling, back to reality. And that was very upsetting. That very first tour in Romania, it was really heartbreaking to see how sad the people seem to be outside of the concert hall, and that extreme of how joyous they were in the hall.
And has that changed? I mean, it's been a while since the Iron Curtain came down, and you know, countries are part of the European Union now, and yet I still think that there may be a difference of feeling in the former bloc countries.
I think there's still a sense that that music is really important. It's part of their history, it's part of their culture. The concerts are still really packed out. They're still enormously enthusiastic. And you have a feeling that it really does matter to them enormously. But of course, what's happened is that they have new opportunities. Bulgaria is part of the European Union. And so the young musicians who, many of them, there are many young musicians who come to the concerts. There were a lot at my concerts recently. And within the orchestra, the professionals are also quite a lot of younger players, which is really encouraging. But of course, now they have the opportunity to find work outside of Bulgaria in richer countries. And that's going to be the really big challenge. Are they going to lose that culture because people are bringing their children up thinking, well, if you want really good opportunities in other countries, then go into business or go into something else. Music isn't obviously the obvious thing. And yet somehow music is still that, feels that kind of freedom that it brings people, and musicians there seem to be very hungry for musical contact and musical experiences. So it's a kind of mixed feeling. And I came away from this recent trip feeling, well, of course, that life is much better for musicians and probably for many of the audience too. But are we looking at the end of a sort of very big historical lineage? And, you know, I mean, around the world, there are very famous Bulgarian and Romanian, Hungarian musicians performing, and they bring something, you know, spectacular to the music scene. And one just hopes that that is not going to change. There are still going to be fantastic talents that come out of countries like Bulgaria. They enhance all of our lives. And the important thing now is for us from those other countries to make sure that we are still going there, that we still take it very seriously, that we feed the audiences there as much as we can. You know, even if the local musicians are trying to do the same elsewhere.
Right. I was going to say it's also important, I think, to remember that those places welcome tourists, too. And I have to say, Bulgaria is one of the most beautiful countries I've ever seen. I've been lucky enough to travel from one end of it to the other, from the mountains to the plains in the middle, all the way to the Black Sea on the eastern coast. And it is a spectacularly beautiful country that is very sparsely populated, you know, so you get to see a lot of the unspoiled country, but the people who are there desperately need income, and they need an economy in order to keep musicians performing and artists working and, you know, people growing food and all of the things that we all do, you know, to keep a society going.
You're very aware when you're traveling that, you know, outside of the cities that you know, there are some very poor people. I mean, actually, I flew into Bucharest in Romania because it was the closest connection, and then was driven in a car for an hour, a couple of hours over the border, over the Danube River to Rusa in the north of Bulgaria. And, you know, you do see real poverty and you know, people that you feel have been left really behind. And there's so much that has to be done. And as I said, it's we musicians who are really gypsies anyway. It's necessary for us to go and play in these places, whether there's money or not, because we have to do this because we love music and because we love the roots of music. And Romania and Bulgaria, there are so many musicians historically that have come from there and composers. And we need to keep feeding that and making sure that, you know, people do have a real sense that it still is amazingly important for all of our lives.
And that they have something to contribute as well.
Yes. I have some beautiful stories about students that I taught in masterclasses in Bulgaria many years ago who grew up. I saw them over the years giving classes there. And then finally they blossomed into, you know, wonderful artists who now travel the world and bring people's attention to the fact that, you know, great culture is produced by people from countries like that where, you know, it's not what everybody's expecting, really, is it?
No. But it's very much worth paying attention to.
It is. And it draws me very much to go back. And I think it does to other musicians as well. But I hope that we can all do that. We can all feel that draw to be supportive and at the same time to be also inspired by that sense of history and the sense of how important music is, because we're very privileged. And in America, you know, it's almost taken for granted now that it's going to be there. And it isn't necessarily, but certainly in countries like Bulgaria, you know, it needs to be a priority, I think.
When are you going back? Do you know?
Well, I'm sure I'll go back next year. There's no doubt about that. So it'll be another, you know, 12 months or something like that. But that's the normal pattern. And I'm looking forward to it because I feel very much attached to Bulgaria from that point of view. I mean, it has been many years and I've had a lot of amazing experiences there. And the people are very special and very warm and communicative, and they really show how much they value having that musical collaboration and the inspiration that, you know, sometimes comes from the outside as well.
Well, as always, we have such a wonderful conversation, bridging the gap from, in this case, across the pond. But I am so looking forward to continuing them in the months to come, Robert. Have a wonderful month of May, and we will talk in June.
Thank you, Bonnie. Always lovely to talk to you.
Robert Cohen is an internationally acclaimed cellist. He joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North every month for a segment called On That Note. You can hear all of their past episodes at WUWM.com.
Buying a struggling English language bookstore in Paris might not be a plan suggested by a financial advisor, but that's what a fictional Milwaukeean does in a new novel by writer Liam Callanan. We'll talk with him about Paris by the Book when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. If there are any themes that fiction readers have warmed to in recent years, they would include Paris and bookshops, sometimes bookshops in Paris.
But none of them have woven Milwaukee into that mix until now. Wisconsin novelist Liam Callanan's new novel features a Milwaukee woman married to a writer who suddenly goes missing. She and her two adolescent children go looking for him, a journey that leads them to buy a bookshop in Paris.
What do they find? Well, that is contained in the pages of the novel Paris by the Book, which just came out last month. Liam Callanan, who is an occasional Lake Effect essayist, joins us in the studio to offer a preview. It is great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thanks. It's been a fun ride so far.
Well, good. as it should be, I would hope. When did you first go to Paris?
I first went to Paris when I was in college. And it left a wonderful impression on me, of course. But I didn't get back to Paris until years later with my family. And so I think the first time that I was able to go with my kids, it was probably in 2012 or thereabouts. And like many Milwaukee families, we looked up come springtime and realized that we needed to definitely have a spring break. And I was looking at flights to Florida and hotels there, and they were awfully expensive. And then I saw a Paris flight advertised come across, and I said, wait a second, we could go to Paris for less than it would cost to go to Florida? And the truth was, we could go for much less. And so I redirected our efforts, and off we went to Paris. And the weather was exactly like it is on the east side of Milwaukee where we live. It was cold and wet and rainy, but it was wonderful. And my girls were captivated by the city. And we wandered around town exploring nooks and crannies, guided a lot by their obsession and fascination with a couple of children's books, the Madeline series from Ludwig Bemelmans, and then The Red Balloon, which is also a film by Albert Lamourisse. And so exploring all those places really just kind of opened up the city in a new way to me. And on the last day of that trip, we went into a little English language bookstore that was kind of in the process of closing down, where it appeared, we didn't know that at first, but the place was kind of a very picturesque mess. And as we were checking out, the woman took a long look at us and said, do you think you'd like to buy the store? And she was half joking, but only half. And she thought we might be the right sort of family because our daughters clearly love books and I love books. And I was a writer. And so she thought we might be a good match. And for a long afternoon as we walked away from that store, we wondered if we might be a good match. We were trying to calculate exactly how long it would take us to lose our entire life savings in Paris. And we thought we would have a good 8 months before it all went south. Many people subsequently offered to work for us for free in the store, but no one ever offered to give us money to to buy the store. And so we didn't buy it. But in this new book, I do get a bookstore in Paris. And so that's just one of the wonderful ways that fiction opens up new worlds for you. You can kind of like write your way there. A little bit like, was it Milo in The Phantom Toll
Booth? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kind of drew himself forward. So I think that's, I'm looking forward to that too. Or Harold.
Exactly.
Harold and the Purple Crayon. Yeah. he drew the path forward, and I was doing that in this book as well.
You mentioned The Red Balloon, and I certainly remember the film The Red Balloon when I was young. I had these kind of, their sepia-toned memories, partly because I'm sure the print I saw of the film was so faded in some at some level. But as you describe, the Red Balloon figures prominently in this book. It occurs to me that maybe the memories aren't so much faded colors as it was that was what the film actually looked like. It is a Paris that is very gray except for this balloon.
It is. It's fascinating, the story of the Red Balloon itself, because it came out in the mid-50s, and it won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, which is ironic because it's probably only 30 words of dialogue in the whole piece. It's only 30 minutes long. And it's hypnotized a generation of generations of American kids, especially in the 70s and 80s when thousands of copies were distributed in American classrooms and people would always watch it during recess. And, you know, it sounds like you're like me. It was just absolutely captivated by this Paris. And I've always thought it was a strange film to captivate you by because it's a pretty bleak and gritty and gray Paris. But I do think that for a certain sort of artistically minded soul, that it kind of appeals to us all the more because it feels real in a way. It feels like we're not seeing Paris through rose-colored glasses. We're actually getting some sort of a real Paris. But of course, it's just another version of a Paris myth. And so, if anything, that kind of notion of kind of a gray and gritty Paris also appeals to some sort of deep part of us that we want it to be. You know, we want to be the one to kind of go over there and fix it. And I think that the way the Red Balloon haunts people, I think is in part because of it kind of plucks some sort of longing deep inside us, which matches that gray and red landscape.
And in contrast, there's the Paris of the Madeline books,
right,
which is much
much sunnier,
yeah,
and like literally sunnier, because he's got a sun in a lot of shots. So though, to his credit, he does paint a page or two of them wandering through the rain. But those are kids' books. That's for a younger set. Although really not. I mean, the Red Balloon goes pretty young too. But so the Madeline series is, to my mind, it's just kind of like painted with a lot more joie de vivre, I guess we would say. There's a lot more dash and color and style, and it's sunny. And I think between the two of them, between LaMaurice and Bemelmans, between the Red Balloon and the Madeline books, I mean, that's how kids went to France. I think that's how a lot of people still go to France. And I mean that metaphorically, but also, like, literally. Like, I think that those books take many, many people to France just because they're transported there. And so it's two different ways of looking at a city, is how I claim it in the book. And so my book kind of joins that conversation where, you know, this young woman from the east side of Milwaukee is going off looking for her husband, who's just abjectly disappeared from their house one day. And she gets some clues that lead her to believe that they might be going, that he might have disappeared to Paris. Other people think he just disappeared into the lake because he left absolutely no trace. So
he's kind of a tortured writer, if I can call him that.
Which is odd because I don't know any tortured writers myself, and I certainly am not one myself. But there's a certain type, and he's a tortured writer, and who also wrote children's literature. And so he was a big fan of both of these artists. And what he liked about them, which is kind of what I like about LaMaurice and Bemelmans, is both of them were really complicated individuals. And so is Leah, the narrator of my book. She finds her husband Robert's pretty complicated. So off they go to Paris to kind of search for him. But then Paris itself turns out not to be quite what they expected, and they discover all sorts of things that surprise them along the way.
How did Leah emerge as your narrative voice?
That was a really interesting process. This was the book started a totally different way. I had written it in third person. It was from the husband's perspective. And it was there was a long part in Milwaukee. And then one day I was sitting down to write, and I stared at my computer for a long time. I'd reached kind of a pause point in the narrative. And something that I often tell my students, I teach writing, one thing I often tell my students is if you ever get blocked, just open up another door and try it a different way, and maybe try switching point of view. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that. Today I'll write in the wife's point of view just to kind of see what she's thinking about. Well, it turns out she was thinking about a lot. That day she thought about 1,000 words, and the next day 5,000. Then suddenly I had about 25,000 words all in the wife's perspective, and I thought, she is the most interesting character I've got, and she also has a lot more to say. And so I just hung on for the ride at that point. So she, very much a scene stealer, she wandered into the text and took it over, and a couple hundred thousand words later, she's in charge.
And as we get to know her, she has always wanted to go to Paris, but the only Paris she has been to in the past is Paris, Wisconsin. Both Paris, Wisconsins.
Yes.
At a very early, maybe ideal moment in her marriage to Robert.
That's one of the things that fascinated me, is that we do have a Paris, Wisconsin, just south of Milwaukee, actually. And I think that it's not far from where the new Foxconn plant will be. It's just off to the west of 94 if you're heading down to Chicago. And then there's another Paris, Wisconsin. At least the maps say that there's another Paris, Wisconsin out in the southwest of the state. But I couldn't find a sign out there. One of the things that struck me about both Paris, Wisconsins, and for that matter, these notion of all the Parises across the United States, there are more Parises in the United States than any other foreign capital. And I feel like this is a place that people have been dreaming of for a while. So there's a Paris, Wisconsin. There's certainly Paris, Texas. There's a Paris, New York. Supposedly, actually, the Paris, Wisconsin was named for the Paris, New York. I like that they weren't dreaming too big down there. They didn't want to presume to be named after Paris, France, but Paris, New York was a safe bet. But it just reminded me of kind of this thing that we do, which is to dream of being in a different spot, but then somehow to try and recreate and tend to that myth in our own backyard. And so I was fascinated by that. At one point, the characters take a world tour But they do it all within the state of Wisconsin. So they go down from Luxembourg up north of Milwaukee. And
Belgium's up there as well.
Yeah, Belgium and Cuba City and Paris and the other Paris. And of course, there's New Berlin. So there's all these places you can go. And I just like this idea that people are kind of constantly tending to these stories outside themselves. And it turned out to be one of the things that my book was about.
Paris, the one in France anyway, is the setting for so many great works of literature. How well do you feel like you had to know it to credibly represent it, to do it justice as it is, as opposed to this, you know, idealized Madeline version that maybe we got when we were 5 or 6?
That was the most terrifying aspect of the whole thing, was because I was entering, my first novel was set in Alaska, and fewer people know Alaska as well as Paris. And Paris belongs to everyone, particularly Parisians. And so it was a big challenge for me to get right. And I have not lived in Paris. I visited many times, and I visited a few times more during the drafting of this book. And so every day that I would go to work on this, I would try to go to Paris in the sense that before I started my writing day, I would start with some language review, like French language review, just to kind of get French in my head. I listen to these wonderful sound artists. Luckily, the internet is a wide enough place that there are people who literally just wander cities, particularly Paris, with a ambient mic on and just capture the sounds of the scene. And so I would put my headphones on. I would download a 2-hour file of someone who was walking across Paris. That Paris does not fill with wheezing accordions and people selling flowers.
It's not all Edith Piaf songs.
No, it isn't. I mean, there's a couple people, but otherwise it's not. It's, it's Chilean pan flutes, and it's that two-tone European siren that sounds so distinctive. It's motos buzzing by. It's tiny little diesel trucks. It's people kind of shouting as they try the buses that honk and horn. And I realize, and that just put me in mind of, like, I want to make sure that the Paris that is here is real in the sense that it's an actual, like, urban place that people will recognize. So it's interesting. I had some people in Paris read the book, and it was interesting that they would disagree and agree over different things. Some of them would say, this is exactly like Paris, and then other would say, like, it was not. They were talking about the exact same thing. And I thought, well, you know what? I think I've got it right then. If they're disagreeing, then all the facets of Paris have been covered.
Well, and your book is being distributed and published in a variety of places, but at its heart, you know, this is an American whose experience. I mean, Leah is really going there for the first time, and so this is an American experiencing it versus a German person versus an English person.
Exactly, and versus a French person.
Right.
So it's a very And so I make no claims for a universal Paric experience. I think it's very authentic to her experience, and I think her expat experience over there is to kind of see Paris through a very, in some ways, narrow window, because she hasn't mastered French yet. She spends the book trying to learn it better, which is not unlike myself. And
her daughters get it faster than she does.
Her daughters get it faster than she does, which they assure me up at the Alliance Française, where I've been studying, that happens very familiar. The kids get it, and the parents trail along behind. And so that's been my experience. But in her case, I think she also finds that, expat life can be really lonely when you don't share the language, and life in a big city can be really challenging, especially when navigating the bureaucracy of a place like Paris. And so I think that was part of what I wasn't attempting to provide a real Paris so much as I was attempting to provide a Paris that was true to her outlook.
And at one level, she is there because she is looking for her husband, but she is looking for something bigger too.
She is. I think she's looking for a lost piece of herself, not to sound too romantic about it, but I think that when her husband disappears, she realizes that more is at stake than her marriage. I think she's also realizing that her own definition of what she thought and life was going to be like, adulthood, parenthood, and what sort of dreams that she has. It's something that she goes through the book trying to sort through, like, what does it mean to be a mom? What does it mean to be a bookstore owner? What does it mean to be an American in Paris? She's very conscious of her nationality and status a lot of times. And then what does it mean when a place like Paris or the life you thought you were going to lead doesn't exactly turn out to square with that? How do you navigate the gap between the reality and myth that you had? I think it's one of the things that really obsesses her in the book.
Well, Liam Callanan, I will have you know that as I was reading this book, I was busy pricing out flights to Paris, so job well done.
Oh, excellent. Good. I should put a coupon on the back for that. It really is. It's people, I've become a new booster for Paris, and I think that not that Paris needed much more boosting, but I think people think of it as it's unreachable. It's quite reachable. Especially for people who've tuned into Lake Effect from the Milwaukee Reason, because you can get to Chicago and you can be in Paris in 8 hours. And folks, when you tune into the show next, you should be in Paris. You can also catch WWM in Paris on the internet. So you won't be that disconnected.
Liam, thanks. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Merci.
Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan's latest novel is called Paris by the Book. Our interview first aired last month. And that's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Great to have you with us today, and I hope you can stop by again tomorrow at 10 o'clock for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock now, and fresh air is next. Avec des gigots.